discuss the Darush of Achnai, the oven of Achnai. And I would like to begin this class by briefly reviewing the subject, trying to briefly review some of the things that we said for those of you who are not present, and then go a little bit further and then conclude this discussion about the oven of Achnai. The oven of Achnai is an Agadah. It is an Agadah that is known by that name, Tanush al Achnai. Achnai is a snake, and the snake really has either something to do with the shape of the oven, or, in fact, the way the Gemara discusses it, it has to do with the way in which there were arguments that were tied up and around all over this oven about whether it was tameh or tahor, whether it was ritually impure or pure. The question, as we had summarized it, the theoretical question was, in the laws of purity and impurity, in order for an object to be able to contract tum'ah, ritual impurity, that object must be a usable object. We went from there to talk about, well, what happens if you break the object? Well, it is no longer a usable object. At a point it becomes no longer the original object, in which case it no longer has the tum'ah. So in fact, you can create a new object from a former object, and it can actually lose its tumah. It breaks. Then the question came to be, well, what if you glue it together again? And that was the subject of the Tanur Shel Achnai, where in fact the oven that had three parts was cemented together again, cemented in not epoxy, because it would frankly be a different argument if you had epoxy glue. It would be a stronger cement. This was a flimsier cement, and the question was, is this a reconstituted object? And we saw that there were two differences, two opinions on this, that of Rabbi Eliezer and that of the rabbis. The rabbis in the story are in the name of Rabbi Yehoshua. So it's an argument between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. We saw that Rabbi Eliezer was a well-respected rabbi. We looked last time at his own personal history. I read to you the Agadah in the Tanchuma about the unique history of Rabbi Eliezer, that he had a wealthy father who was well-positioned with the Romans, and that he was a key player. He is drawn to Jerusalem and to the yeshiva of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and is therefore a major figure in the early period right after the destruction of the Second Temple. Rabbi Eliezer is quite convinced of his point of view, and he says, if I am right, let the walls of this Beit Midrash prove it, at which point the walls collapse. And Rabbi Yehoshua then yells at the walls and says, how can you do something like that? What business do you have making these decisions? And the walls then go partially up, because in deference to Rabbi Yehoshua, they don't go, they don't fall down, but in deference to Rabbi Eliezer, they don't go all the way up. The carob tree is brought to bear. And the carob tree, if I'm right, let this carob tree be uprooted. And of course, the carob tree is uprooted 500 meters. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, we don't take any proofs from carob trees. And then Rabbi Eliezer says, if I am right, let this river prove it. And the river turns around completely and goes in the opposite direction. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, we simply don't take any proofs from rivers. And finally, Rabbi Eliezer says, if I'm right, let the heavens proclaim it. After which a voice comes out from heaven and says, Rabbi Eliezer is definitely right. To which Rabbi Yehoshua answers, we don't pay any attention to voices from heaven. The question is, well, why don't we pay any attention to voices from heaven? The Brita goes on a little bit further and says, well, we don't pay any attention to the voices that come from heaven because once the Torah is given, the Torah itself tells us that the law is to be decided by the judges in that time, by the rabbis. And therefore, whatever opinion heaven has is totally irrelevant. It simply matters whatever the majority decides, because that is the way God set up the system. Okay? Then, sometime later, Rabbi Nathan happens to be walking outside and he sees Elijah the prophet. And since Elijah the prophet has a very good relationship to God, and he comes back and forth between this world and the next, Rabbi Nathan says to Elijah, no, Elijah, tell me, how did God react to this whole thing when it was happening? And Eliyahu Navi says to Rabbi Nathan, Kachayich, God smiled, Va'amar nitzchuni banai, nitzchuni banai. And God then said, my children have won. My children have won. They have prevailed. My children. That is the end of the Baraita. But the story goes on. And it could be that what we now have is an additional Baraita. Or it could be that this is the original Baraita. It's not really clear. Amru Oto Hayom Hevio Kol Torot Shetiher Rabbi Eliezer. That day, all of the things that Rabbi Eliezer had declared to be pure were brought, Usrafum Ba'esh, and they burned them in fire. Nimnu Alav Uberchu. The rabbis then took a vote, and they excommunicated him. Remember, Berchuhu is a euphemism. Berchuhu normally would mean they blessed him. In fact, it means they cursed him. It's a euphemism because you wouldn't say that they cursed him. Of course, what does it mean to curse? They put it in nidui. Nidui is a form of excommunication. They said, who will go and tell him that this vote has been taken? And Rabbi Akiva says, I will go, lest someone else go, and who is less diplomatic, and he will really go and the whole world will be destroyed as a result. Because you're dealing with someone who is a great figure. Rabbi Eliezer is an enormous figure in the tradition. Rabbi Eliezer is the person you see for whom God will come in and take his side. So that even though there is no halakhic significance to that, still there's no question about the fact that he is significant, and therefore that the way he is treated will be very significant. And Rabbi Akiva goes and with a series of euphemistic statements conveys to Rabbi Eliezer that in fact he has been excommunicated. Rabbi Eliezer understands it. And he tears his garments, he removes his shoes, all of which is the proper behavior for the person who has been put under a ban by the court. V'nishmat v'yashav al gabei karka zalgu einav d'ma'ot. That is a crucial piece of the story, that his eyes flowed with tears. Lakach, the world at that point was smitten. Shlosh bezeitim u'shlosh bakitim u'shlish basarim. One third of the olives and one third of the wheat and one third of the barley became ruined. Yesh omrim af batzek shibiyedei isha tafach. Even dough already in a woman's hands became spoiled. Right? Now, maybe another baraita is attached to this. Tana af gadolaya ba'otayom. There was great anger. Okay? These manifestations of destruction were examples of divine anger. Now, why there was divine anger, of course, there really are two possibilities here. One possibility is that God made his will known. His will was according to Rabbi Eliezer, and the will was rejected. So on the one hand, I think that that is an undercurrent of possibility here, why there is divine anger. That is certainly not the way the Gemara will understand it. The Gemara will understand this to be that Rabbi Eliezer was, even though it makes sense in the context, he was dealt with a level of harshness which was inappropriate. Somehow that's the case. Okay? Shebechol makom shenatan bo einav Rabbi Eliezer nisraf. Every place that he cast his eyes, that place was burned up. Va'af Rabban Gamliel aya babi sinat. Rabban Gamliel, who was the head of the court and who came, he was in a boat. The boat nearly sank. And Rabban Gamliel says it was because of Rabbi Eliezer. Namely, we did something that was very upsetting, and because he was upset. Now, of Rabbi Eliezer's behavior, the things that we know were, according to the law, were the things, the rending of the garments, the sitting on the ground. Those we know are simple parts of the law that are obligatory upon the person placed under the ban. What the fact that stands out in the story is that he wept. That's a very personal thing. It's an emotional statement that has nothing to do with the halacha at all. But we see that he weeps. Okay? Then we learn this story of Ima Shalom, the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, who from that point on makes sure that he never davens tachanun in the morning. Right? She talks to him every morning when it comes time for tachanun, because she knows that if he ever has a chance to say tachanun, he'll start weeping. And if he weeps, God will hear his weeping. And God will be upset with the court that put him under the ban. And it was her brother who was the head of the court. And so she didn't want to play around with something that was really dangerous here, so she just saw to it that he wouldn't have the opportunity to ever say tachanun. Until one day, apparently she mixes it up because it's a day that she didn't think it was Rosh Chodesh. Turns out to be a two-day Rosh Chodesh. And she thought that there was no tachanun, and there was tachanun. It was a one-day Rosh Chodesh. And therefore she was doing something else at that point, and he then says tachanun. Or there's another story that's told here, and that is the possibility that a poor man came to the door, and she, as of course a any tzaddeket, would of course go to the take care of the poor man and to give him some bread to eat. So whatever the particular causes, Rabbi Eliezer has a chance to say tachanun, and then her reaction to that tachanun is, "My brother died." So he says, "How do you know your brother? How do you know your brother died?" The answer is, "Because you said tachanun. The minute that you had a chance to say tachanun, my brother, he's a gun. He's dead. He's dead on arrival. D.O.A. Okay." And of course, no sooner does that happen than the word goes out that Rabban Gamliel has died. Okay? The Shipura goes out, like a shofar, the message is broadcast that Rabban Gamliel has died. Okay? And as the end of the story comes, Amar la, minaya dat, how did you know about Raman Gamliel's death? This is 59b3. Amar le, she said to him, kach mekublani mibet adi abba. So I have a tradition from the house of my grandfather. And she comes from the house of Raman Gamliel. The note here is that this is a tradition that goes back to King David's son. It's a very old tradition. Kol hasharim min alim chutz misha'arei ona'a. All of the gates are closed except for the gate of ona'a. Ona'a meaning ona'at devarim. Ona'at devarim meaning offending somebody with words. Right? Hurting a person's feelings with words. So that, to review what I said last time, the first of the conclusions that one has from this story is that in the context, the entire story comes in order to get at this end. It is edited into the text in the Bavli, in such a way that its final conclusion is to support what we learned before this, which, if you remember, was that you have to be particularly concerned about the feelings of your wife. And you should not hurt your wife's feelings by speaking to her harshly. Why? Because women are emotional. And therefore, you have to be very careful not to do that. That is immediately followed now by the story of Rabbi Eliezer, okay? And then of the death of Rabban Gamliel. And the way this is woven in is clearly in order to make the point of how terrible Ona'at Devarim is, that it is such a serious matter, that when you hurt somebody with words, you cause them great heartache, and the divine sphere is filled with tremendous anger. That is what fills the divine with anger. Okay? Now, Professor Rubinstein, who is a professor of, teaches Talmud at NYU, Jeffrey Rubinstein, published a book entitled Talmudic Stories, where what Rubinstein does is takes agadot, and mostly agadot, and the principal agadot, although sometimes agada is in a halachic context, as is this one almost, and reflects on these agadot largely from the perspective of what I would call the scientific study of Judaism, the Wissenschaft des Judentums, that is to say, what do we learn about the editing of the text? And what Rubinstein does is that Rubinstein shows that, for example, the essential pieces of the first Baraita already appear in the Talmud Yerushalmi. They appear in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, in the Masechet of Moed Katan, in the tractate Moed Katan. And Moed Katan is the tractate that we studied when we were studying the laws of mourning. The third chapter of Moed Katan is about mourning. We began a few pages in because the very first subject begun in that third chapter is the subject of putting a person under a ban, and of tzara'at, when a person contracts leprosy or something like leprosy. The laws of mourning are similar to those two categories, and that's why the third chapter of Moed Katan was about that. In the third chapter of Moed Katan, in the Bavli and in the Yerushalmi, but especially in the Yerushalmi, there is an extended discussion of the importance of the court and of the necessity of not going against what the court says. It is a statement of the basic significance of judicial procedure, and that you cannot hold out your point of view against the majority point of view in the court. At that point, this baraita is brought. Okay? So Rubinstein points out that that is its original form. It is then brought in the Bavli for a totally different purpose. The Bavli is not talking about Nidui. The Bavli is not talking about these laws of the ban at all. That's the source of the Baraita, but the Baraita is now brought for another purpose. What is the purpose? The purpose is Ona Atevarim. Ona Atevarim. Because apparently together with that, let's say, Ur Baraita, the original Baraita, were a series of other Baraitot, which we see here, and we see they're brought as Tana. The Tana says, so that we know that it's a new Baraita. But apparently there were a cluster of Baraitas. And part of the Baraita cluster is later edited into the Bavli, which is what we've been reading, and the same story is used for another purpose. I would add to that that the story is 100 times better in the Bavli than it is in the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi, it appears in Aramaic. The literary quality of this story as it appears in the Bavli is, I think, unparalleled. It is one of the finest pieces of literature you'll ever read. It is just every single line is honed, and it's got the characteristics of rabbinic Hebrew, where you don't say too much, you don't say too little. There's a biting sense and a humorous sense to it at the same time that really... Until you have a writer like Shmuel Yosef Agnon writing in Hebrew, in Mishnaic Hebrew, you never see that. It's an utterly awesome reading of classical Hebrew. So, in fact, I think that what we have in the Bavli is a lot better than what we have in the Yerushalmi. I don't know what that means, though. I don't know whether that means that it existed in the ancient period in different forms. That's my hunch is. That already in the ancient period, I cannot believe that what we have read here in the Bavli dates from much beyond the time of the characters in this story. It can't date from beyond the second century. I just can't imagine that. Because we know the Hebrew. We know this Hebrew style. This Hebrew style of the first two centuries. Just anything after that reads differently. It reads differently. This is the classic Hebrew story par excellence. So I think that it really goes way back. It goes way back. He's probably right that there were clusters. There were clusters of baraitot. Well, the cluster, that's my terminology. He's right that there was a baraita used in the Yerushalmi. It is used then for a different purpose in the Bavli. That having been said, I think that it's the fact that it is found in such a pristine form here in the Bavli is because it was seen as making a variety of extremely important theological statements. From the perspective of the rabbis of the Talmud, this was core rabbinic theology. And in several ways, it's core rabbinic theology. First of all, it really defines, this I said last time, it defines the significance of the rabbinic tradition as being the bearers of divine will. Okay, so I think that in a very strong fashion, it is the rabbinic tradition that provides for the continuity of the divine will. That isn't to be taken for granted, even though it is very rooted, of course, in our classical literature. But you could be someone not within that tradition and say they're all wrong, those rabbis. You know, that was dated in time, and we don't go according to what the rabbis said, a bunch of old conservatives. You know, we're modern people. We're Hellenists. We're Romans. We're whatever. We're Persians, and we don't believe in that stuff anymore. Or we're Jewish nationalists, because realize that this, or even that we're Christians. Realize that this is contemporaneous with early Christianity. The story that we are reading about the significance of the rabbinic tradition and the absolute will of God as contained in the rabbinic tradition is happening in the early days of Paul. And what do the rabbis have to demonstrate? Not only as far as the other Jews are concerned, but as far as this upstart new religion is concerned, that says, no, that's wrong. There isn't any rabbinic tradition that really is a compelling tradition. That's not true. There's been a new revelation. We have a New Testament. We have a revelation in Jesus who is resurrected on the third day. And as a result of that, we now know things that really supersede the Old Testament, because there was a New Testament. Okay? You're dealing with early Christianity, which is precisely at this time. So I think that, is it an anti-Christian polemic? I don't know. But I do know that in an environment of the first two centuries, when issues like this were issues in the Jewish community, and we know that they were issues because we have the New Testament. And the New Testament surely talks about these things, and we know the extent to which the New Testament grows out of rabbinic literature. That scholarship has studied a lot in recent times. Hold on just a minute. So, number two, it's not only the rabbis justifying themselves vis-a-vis the Jews, but it is vis-a-vis the Gentiles. The Gentiles. That's point number two. Point number three, it seems to me that even without that, even if none of that was important, we have a very groundbreaking statement of the significance and relationship of the rabbinic tradition to divine revelation. Now, anybody who's interested in the nature of classical Judaism sooner or later wants to know the relation of the rabbinic tradition to the divine revelation. What Rabbi Yehoshua and the rabbis are doing is that they are affirming the independence of rabbinic interpretation from divine intervention. And that is crucial. It is crucial, lo bashamayim, that it is not in the heavens. And therefore, there is a rupture. This we talked about last time, and I thought that your comment was wonderful last time. There was a prophetic period, and now we are in a rabbinic period. Prophetic Judaism waits for divine intervention. Rabbinic Judaism has no patience with divine intervention. They are both Judaism, but they are different Judaisms. And I think that it's important to see Judaism as a religion which has both the prophetic dimension, which in fact is superseded by the rabbinic dimension, as understood, of course, by the rabbis. It's not only superseded by those, it's superseded by a lot of things. But it is superseded eventually by a rabbinic tradition, which does very well in the competition for ideas, by the way. As far as the Jewish community goes, it is very powerful, very successful, probably until the late 18th and the 19th centuries. It's only then. So for about 1800 years, the Jewish community, by and large, accepts the parameters that are laid down in this Agadah. It accepts the nature of rabbinic authority. It isn't really until the Enlightenment begins to have a major impact on Jewish communal life, which is, as I said, the end of the 18th, but really in the 19th century, that that paradigm breaks down. And it doesn't break down so quickly. It's still happening. Early Reform Judaism, for example, if you read Reform Judaism in the middle of the 19th century, Kaufman Kohler, who writes here in America, living in Cincinnati, teaching at the Hebrew Union College, the latter part of the 19th century, writes that, of course, the Torah is true. It is divine revelation. Everything that God said in the Torah was true. Well, by the time you get to the middle of the 20th century, the Reform movement is no longer saying that. But it did initially in the middle of the 19th century. Even the rabbinic tradition had a certain level of validity, although it was something they were tangling with, the Reform movement in the 19th century. It was one of the major issues that was a breaking point between the Reform movement and the conservative movement. As the conservative movement grew in the middle of the 19th century, it was the significance and the continuity of the rabbinic tradition. It was with that, with the more radical ideas about rabbinic authority, that Schechter broke and founded and really built the Jewish Sabbatical Seminary. Because Schechter was a believer in the rabbinic tradition. However, I would say that the last 25 years, I'm not sure that Schechter's legacy is any more in the community that was his community. I don't know where that's gone. I mean, but that, these are the ideas that I'm just saying all of this to you to show how fertile this Agadah is. This is sort of the key Agadah in Jewish theology. Now, if the rabbinic tradition is such, just to step back into it again, to the content, the subject matter, the sages don't set aside their opinion for a divine voice. And if the goal of the Torah is to uncover and live by the divine will, how can the sages reject the heavenly voice? And if you read modern orthodoxy, for example, modern orthodoxy speaks as if there are divine voices happening all the time. The Din Torah, it's absolutely God, it's God's will. The reality is of this that has nothing to do with God's will, it has to do with the sages' will. The sages have their authority on the basis of divine will. Maybe the aim of the study of the Torah is not to reveal an absolute truth, which would be a divine truth. Maybe the reason for the study of the Torah is so that the divine revelation can exist within the parameters of human insights. That is a personal point of view to which I adhere. That in fact, Judaism is not interested in the divine will. Judaism is principally interested in studying the history of the way in which the rabbis have responded to the divine will, the rabbinic tradition, which is why study is our principal occupation, and not philosophical truths. For example, just to contrast this with another type of religion, the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is based on the assumption, according to Thomas Aquinas, that one can know on the basis of philosophy, what is absolutely true and what is God's will in the world. And philosophers have to figure that out. And there is a truth that philosophy can tell us. I would argue that rabbinic Judaism is essentially uninterested in that question. It is not interested in what is true. It is interested in what is the law. What is true is sometimes relevant, because the law is not just something that is absent all concerns for truth, but it is not the same thing. It is not a product of philosophy. It is a product of an ongoing interaction with a history of legal discussions. And, in addition to that, the telling of stories. There's another side to this. And that's why I mentioned to you that I thought it would be worthwhile to say a few words about some of the issues raised, and they're raised largely in the context of Christian philosophy, that you find in the Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. Just a step back from the Brothers Karamazov. I don't know whether any of you saw the movie The Golden Compass. Any of you see that movie? Yeah? Compass. Golden Compass. Yeah? Not a great movie. It's an awful movie. But it's an interesting movie. I'll tell you just in a minute what it was about. It's a science fiction fantasy. And it's about these people, you know, human beings. Everybody has a soul. And the soul can be a rabbit. And the soul is outside you. And if you're alive and well, you have a soul that's sort of inside, but you that inside soul also has an outside manifestation. So everybody sort of runs around with their soul. So one soul is a rabbit, and one soul is a dog, and another one is a cat, and they're cute. You know, it makes for, I don't have to tell you, if you haven't seen Avatar, you know that it's, you know, we should only have, or Zarur should have a little piece of that, what comes in on a Saturday night from a movie like Avatar. People love these kind of fantasies. And nearly all of these fantasies are based on theological ideas. All based on myths. And all myths is theology. So everybody has this soul. And the story in The Golden Compass is that there are, however, a group of people who don't want us to have souls. And they are creating a group of human beings near the North Pole that have had their souls ripped out from them. Well, why don't they want to have souls? Because souls make you unhappy. Because souls give you freedom. And freedom is the essential problem of humanity. This is the Golden Compass. And the people who are trying to make people happier are called the Magisterium. The Magisterium. The Magisterium is figuring out a way of freeing human beings from their greatest problem, which is themselves. And the way you do that is to make sure that human beings no longer are as free as they were when they had free souls. So they put them in this kind of machine where they get them up in this area around the North Pole, and this machine is able to rend the soul from... And then the people are like you and me. They can't do unusual things. They're sort of more regular than they were before. Now, if you'll ever see this movie, which I'm not recommending you spend your time seeing, it is based on exactly the same idea that you have in the Grand Inquisitor chapter of the Brothers Karamazov of Dostoevsky. Because the issue for Dostoevsky is the problem of human freedom. And that human freedom really is, on the one hand, the most important of all human qualities. And yet, on the other hand, the question is whether human beings can ever be happy and free. Any of you who have read the psychological literature, Erich Fromm, for example, writes about freedom. This is Fromm's issue. How do human beings lose their freedom? They can lose their freedom in an economic sense. They can lose their freedom by conformity. They can lose their freedom in a million different ways, which society sees to it that we are not free, that we do not really take upon ourselves the responsibilities of being free human beings. Well, in Dostoevsky, one of the basic themes is that is the cry of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church calls out for human beings to give up their freedom to the Church. Why? Because only through the Church can one be happy. And the only way you can be happy is if you are not free. And the Church offers you the way to be not free. So that is the undercurrent here in the Brothers K. That is what the Church does. And the Church does it for a higher good, for happiness. And Ivan in the Brothers K feels that this is taking away from the human being. And the issue for Dostoevsky is absolute human freedom is what it means to be a human being. And how could you take it away? And of course the Church would say in response, how can we not take it away? There may be a few human beings who can be happy and free. But generally mankind cannot be. Okay? So in this context, Jesus comes back in the Brothers Karamazov. And Jesus comes back and Jesus represents once again absolute freedom. And as soon as the Inquisitor, who is the representative now of the Church, in the movie he was called the Magisterium. Okay, that's what he was called in the movie. He was called the Magisterium, the Inquisitor. The Magisterium wants to remove human freedom. The Inquisitor throws Jesus, who is the messenger of God, in that context, of course. The ultimate meaning of God is absolute freedom. He throws Jesus in jail. And he says to him, we don't need you anymore. Get out of here, because we only care what the Church says. That is to say, lo b'shamayim. Right? The law is no longer in the hands of heaven, it is only in human hands. Okay? Just to give you a sense of this here, this is in the Grand Inquisitor. The prisoner, too, is silent. He looked at him and not say a word, prisoner meaning Jesus. That's inevitable in any case, Ivan laughed again. The old man has told him he hasn't the right to add anything to what he has said of old. Namely, this is the Inquisitor, says to Jesus, you have no right to add anything to the original source. One may say it is the most fundamental feature of Roman Catholicism, in my opinion at least. All has been transmitted by thee to the Pope. Right? Everything now is in the papal tradition, they say. And all, therefore, is now in the Pope's hands. And there is no need for thee to come at all. Right? We don't want to have anything to do with God anymore. Because it's all in the Pope's hands. That's how they speak and write too, the Jesuits at any rate. I've read it myself in the works of their theologians. Hast thou the right to reveal to us one of the mysteries of that world from which thou hast come? My old man asks him. And answer the question for him. No, you have no right, that thou mayest not add to what has been said of old, and you may not take from men the freedom which thou didst uphold when thou wast on earth. Whatever thou revealest anew will encroach on men's freedom of faith. In other words, if you, God, continue to speak any more, you will be taking away from people's freedom. That's what the Magisterium, that's what the Church believes. Okay? Taking away from freedom. Anyway. So the question is, how does this story compare to that? What is the attitude of the rabbis in the Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua? think that, in a way, this is a wonderful comparison between Judaism and Christianity. Because in classical Judaism, remember, was there a Grand Inquisitor here? Was there a magisterium? Was there a desire to get rid of freedom? Absolutely none of those. To the contrary, freedom in Judaism is understood to be within the give and the take of the tradition. Right? That is freedom. Although there are limits to it. Namely, you have to go by what the majority of the law says. Right? It's not an absolute freedom, which would be a sort of 19th and 20th century kind of freedom, where the only real freedom is a freedom of conscience.
It's not an individual freedom.
It's not an individual freedom, correct. Although the individual has a certain level of freedom, but the individual, Rabbi Eliezer, has to give into what the rest of the court says. Okay? He has to do that. And of course, how does God react to all of this?
Our children have
Nitzchuni Banai. He smiles. God loves this. So that this system, then, is a system that has divine favor, has clear divine favor, as opposed to Jesus being thrown in prison, let's say, that the divine is imprisoned. This is the divine who feels that this is the way he set up the world. God enjoys this. God enjoys the give and take of that tradition, and even of those who disagree with him. Okay? So I think on that level, well, what you have here is an extraordinary expression of some of the most fundamental ideas in Judaism, particularly as seen when you compare them to some of the major alternatives, be they that of the classical Christian thinkers or the modernist radical individual freedom. I think that this is a very different idea. Now, all of that having been said, I think that I would just end this exposition by saying that all of this is woven back into the context of the subject and the Bavli. And all of this that is so intellectually grabbing is woven back into the context of the Bavli, which is the need to be careful about what one says. Okay? So that even where we are dealing with the freedom that we have, which is this give and take, even there, or especially, you can see it by the final denouement of the story, especially there, one must be especially careful about what one does, because this freedom has with it tremendous responsibility. Okay. Your comments.
We are playing the game here according to the majority of the rabbi rule in the court. And Rabbi Eliezer comes in front of the court, and the majority ruled against him, and he got his nidui. But I'm sure some of the rabbi on the court were in the minority. Did they get their nidui?
No, because by disagreeing, by having a point different from the majority, you don't get put in nidui for that. You get put in nidui only where you are unwilling to abide by the majority rule, where you say they're wrong and I'm right.
But I don't think and that's what happened. They came to him to ask him questions and he gave his opinion.
Now, this is partly in the Yerushalmi piece of it. The Yerushalmi piece of it, the assumption here is that he will tell you to act according to his will with you. And I'll
so he was a moret.
He was a moret, correct. Correct. Yeah. He was a rebellion.
Somebody on the court is in the opinion of Eliezer.
Nothing wrong with that.
So, but it's not equal punishment to...
Right, I mean, it's nothing wrong with having an opinion.
It's only if you act.
It's acting on the opinion, correct. Once the court ruled that he was wrong, then in fact all of the ovens that he had declared to be pure were impure. And that's why it had to tell us that in the story. Right? Because everything now had to go according to the point of view of the opinion that was the majority.
Of the majority.
Yeah.
Two things. As you were doing this brilliant, brilliant exposition, I remember the phrase "Miyom sheni nechav beit hamikdash nitla nevoa miYisrael." So that was a demarcation.
That's right. From the day that the temple was destroyed, prophecy was taken away from Israel.
But the other thing is that I was hearing echoes forward into the era of the Baal Shem Tov, and he was kind of had a direct, started the movement of the Hasidut, and having the direct experience with the divine, as opposed to the Mitnagdim who wanted to propose it. It says, no, we study the law, and we don't hear voices, and we don't have a direct connection with the divine.
Exactly.
So I think that this whole trend, historical trend that you brought it into the 20th century started to be in the era in which you said the Enlightenment.
Correct. Very much so. Well, actually, in the Hasidic world, for example, some of that starts possibly before that.
Yeah.
Because historians will point to some, two things. This is in Gershom Scholem's studies of Shabtai Tzvi. In his book on Shabtai Tzvi, he looks back at a few different things. One is the Luriana Kabbalah and the impact that Kabbalah has on this. As Kabbalah gives a certain amount of power to the individual. And power, when the individual gets, the more power the individual has, the more likely it is that the individual will be drawn toward antinomian religious experience. That's the terminology. Antinomian means anti-legal religious experience. Because it says, my experience is such that I know what to do. Okay? Now, for us moderns, we take that for granted. You have to argue very hard to realize that there might be another alternative to that, because we take so much for granted that experience should be the ultimate arbiter of everything. But that surely wasn't the case in the classical tradition, and Scholem attributes part of this movement going back to the middle 16th century and the Luriana Kabbalah. In addition to that, when you do have heresy, which you have a few debacles of heresy in the 17th century in the Jewish community. First one was Shabtai Tzvi. All this comes in the second half of the 17th century. And then you have some host Sabbateans, they are called, the Frankists, who are in Eastern Europe. So that one of the reasons that Hasidism, by the time you get to the 18th century, is on such walks on eggshells in a way, is because the nomists, those who believe in the importance of the legal tradition, say, look, if you are willing to go according to experience, look what just happened. There was Shabtai Tzvi, and he was a heretic. He eventually became a Muslim. Right? Or look at the Frankists. They rejected the law. They began sleeping with each other's wives. Okay? They had all kinds of heretical ideas. So that's why anything that began to emphasize individual experience was particularly difficult in the early 18th century. Late 18th and early 19th century.
Scholem says in his introduction to a major trend in Jewish mysticism, he makes the statement that mystics are rebels.
Correct. That's correct.
And that's what it is. Correct.
Their own. Correct,
absolutely.
Well, I have to say that.
Hold on just a second.
I'm very upset.
Don't get upset.
The reason I'm upset is because I've been coming to class and studying to find the truth. And you're telling me that the truth really isn't important, forget about it, to study the law. And I say to myself, listening to the modern Orthodox community, which I'm exposed to a lot, as you know, the question is, which law? Is it the guys in Israel, or is it the guys here? Is it this board or that board, the individual rabbis. Now there's a whole thing over to who can convert and what the conditions are between. It's a hot topic in the modern Orthodox community.
Mm-hmm.
And if all I have to do is listen to the Lord, I don't have to study at all. All I have to do is listen to you.
You don't have to listen. I didn't say that. I wouldn't want you to take that conclusion from this. What I am arguing for is that the study of the law is the manifestation of the divine, as opposed to God's coming down and telling us what he thinks. I'm saying that the study of the law itself is, as far as human beings go, closest that you can get to the divine voice. Okay? So that I think that while I'm not sure that you are finding out what the truth is, there you got me. You're right. I'm not sure that that's the truth, because I'm not sure we'll ever know what the truth is. What I do know is that we do have the law and we have the history of tangling with it and trying to come to understand it. Inevitably, therefore, what you have concluded is correct, namely that there will be different understandings of the law. That having been said, I would say to you the following. There are two things to think about. One is that if you are in search of the primal experience, you have to study the law. Okay? That's more important than knowing the truth, is studying the law. Okay? Secondly, you're right, you have to think about where you're going to find out what you should be doing. And that becomes a very pressing issue. And I think that explains why in the community that you're referring to, it is such a pressing issue. Because it's a natural issue in that community. Okay? And it is also in our, let's say, our more left-wing, but somewhat attached to the law community from the conservative movement. We're fighting about the same thing.